Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hi, my name is Felipe Mendoza. I'm currently a managing director at StoneX Wealth Management, responsible for development, deployment of capital, asset location, portfolio selection for ultra high net worth individuals and family offices.
Felipe, thanks so much for making time join us on the Ivy Podcast. Before we dive in and talk a lot more about your current role, current organization, which is very exciting, give us a thumbnail version of your career prior to that.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, thanks for having me. Truly appreciate the invite. Thumbnail version. Here you go. Let's try and make it happen. I'm Brazilian, born and raised in the state of Rio de Janeiro. And despite being in the finance world my whole career, I'm actually a lawyer in Brazil. Went to law school in Rio. And when I was 18 years old, I started my internship at what is now called BTG Pactual, which I think is the largest investment bank in Latin America. So my first 6 years was truly devoted to the legal aspect of things, but mainly focused on international markets, both for the asset management and wealth management. Then in 2012, after working several months for a good project with probably the largest sovereign wealth fund in the world, still on the legal side of things for BTG, I was invited by one of the senior partners of the firm in the US to move to New York to join their global distribution team. And at that time, I was, should I say yes? Should I say no? If I say yes, my life will turn upside down. If I say no, I might lose the opportunity of my life. Of course, I said yes. And of course, my life turned upside down in a good way. I exchanged a super sunny Rio de Janeiro for a freezing cold New York and spent the following 6 years fundraising for institutional investors. So sovereign wealth funds, pension funds, endowments, foundations across the globe for numerous opportunities in Latin America, be it real estate, timberland, private and public equities, you name it. And then in 2018, I was then invited to join the wealth management team in Miami as a portfolio manager, helping Brazilian and Latin investors to access international markets, right? And finally, in February 2020, I was already, 14 years with BTG, not knowing that COVID would hit as hard as it did, unfortunately. But BTG was my second family, but I thought I needed something different. I think I deserved some new experience in life. And alongside a former BTG Pactual employee as well, and Merrill Lynch, a good friend of mine, Juliana de Souza, we joined forces with StoneX, which is a Fortune 100 company, NASDAQ listed, to develop their international wealth management platform. That's where I am now.
Well, that's super exciting. And thanks for sharing such a diverse background. So congrats on all of the accomplishments as well. Everything that you've accomplished so far is definitely very impressive. So fast forward, you're now with Stone Wealth Management. Share a little bit more insight in terms of what falls under your purview. What is your area of responsibility?
Of course. Yeah, happy to do so. So I think the idea, about leaving BTG and joining forces with StoneX is, we realized that, in the wealth management world and, deploying capital, you have a huge spectrum of investors, right? You go from retail all the way to institutional investors. And we saw that, and because I think there was a cultural aspect of it as well, taking a step back on Brazilians, they never liked or wanted to invest offshore or internationally outside of Brazil because they didn't need it. I think interest rates were super high. I think they're in their comfort zone, right? Things change completely and dramatically. And I think investors and especially Brazilians were pushed to look, think outside the box, and then comes international markets. And we realized, Juliana and I, we realized that, there's a specific niche of clients that were, underserved and were that between $1 million and $10 million or $20 million dollars to invest. And even family offices down in Brazil, I think they had a really hard time concentrating things in one company, one-stop shop. So we're trying to make things easier to invest and deploy capital internationally. So my responsibility, my you know, day-to-day is to deploy capital prudently to investors. There's also an educational component of it because, you know, if you're just investing in Brazil, you probably tap only 3 to 5% of what's out there in terms of, you know, potential in terms of investments. So adding US, it's not only a strong currency, but also so many, there's so much more to it. You can do so much more with your money. So it's kind of educational phase and being closer to the clients and understanding, you know, not only their, you know, 6 month, a year, but 20, 30 year down the road, what they think about, you know, their portfolio, their families, how they think about innovation, how they think about, you know, growing sustainability, ESG, that kind of thing. So it's a lot, but it's fun at the same time.
Well, that's definitely sounds like a very exciting journey in terms of what are you guys building right now. So you've been in investing wealth management for quite some time now, and you've probably seen the markets and industry just going in all different cycles and iterations, different periods in time, also impacted the way people invest, what they invest into. Share with us any of the latest trends that you're personally very excited about. What are you researching these days? What's on your plate that you're tinkering with on nights and weekends?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's a really good question to start things off, and thanks for that. I'll try perhaps to narrow it down, perhaps on focusing on the trend portion of your question, and then maybe giving a few ideas that we are looking at. So I left Brazil in early 2013, right, and those next 6 years in New York allow me to truly appreciate some groundbreaking evolution in finance as a whole. Especially when you deal with super large clients who are usually at the forefront of the industry, of the demands, acting most like a think tank, if you will. I could really see the evolution. You can think about ESG adoption, right? People thinking more about the environment. You'd see a sovereign wealth fund investing oil and charcoal and all those things, and then moving on to, I need to think more broadly in more sustainably about the world. And then you go from ESG that, you know, some people think it's basic, and now it's basic, but it wasn't 30 years ago. But now, you know, if you go from ESG, you have blockchain, you have Bitcoin, that things were unheard of 30 years ago, 20, 30 years ago. So those things are very exciting, but there's one, and maybe I'm biased, but there's one truly trend that I may call it secular trend, which is the evolution of the client advisory relationship. And think, for example, for parents, you know, you're a dad, you probably know that there's no greater joy than creating a better life for your children, right? So for families that have generated considerable wealth through family business or simply by just investing, I think this objective comes with a, you know, set of, you know, natural opportunities and challenges, right? And wealth creators have the chance, I think, truly have the chance to sustain not just family wealth, but also to pass on the values and education future generations need to find success and satisfaction, right? So as families adapt to longer life expectancy, which is, you know, it's a reality, it's a good reality, right? 20 years, we're living 10, 15, 20 years more than we used to 100 years ago. And as they adapt to this new reality and craft a values-driven investment strategy, I think the importance of a trusted advisor is one clear thing. And perhaps, again, I'm biased, but it's a clear thing that I love to be a part of. And I think truly, truly families need experts to provide information and guidance, but they also need really good business partners to tell the difficult truths and ask the right questions and in the right moments, right? So in general, I think if you want to summarize this whole thing we're discussing now, I think that the humanization of finance, you know, being closer to your clients, understanding their background, where they want to be in 20 years from now, I think this is one thing I truly admire and like to be a part of. So that's a big trend, right? And in terms of ideas, it's Well, something I'm a big fan is innovation, right? I believe, fortunately or unfortunately, that, you know, after 2020, no one can afford to say that technology is not here, or technology or innovation for itself, they're not here to stay, right? So if we can say that this whole pandemic situation brought something positive for us to think about, it's you know, perhaps how much more you can do from home, right? With your cell phones, tablets, computers, whatever. So I might be wrong, John, of course, and I usually am, but, you know, 5G technology, you know, artificial intelligence, robotics, cybersecurity, water and waste management, you know, going back to ESG things, biotech, life sciences, they all gain substantial momentum, but I think they're here to stay. And those ideas, and thankfully, we can find really good mentors to partner with and deploy capital to these kind of ideas.
Yeah, that's definitely very interesting. And I appreciate you being generous with some of the information that you share from at least a personal perspective as far as trends and ideas that are very exciting, at least to you. You've mentioned innovation, and you couldn't have set me up any better for kind of the next thing that I want to discuss with you is specifically on that, on innovation, on how to build and foster the culture of innovation, whether that's internally at your company right now, or as you work with your clients, your investors, and so forth. The need for continuous innovation is always at the forefront. You have to innovate yourself. You have to innovate your services and everything that you offer. Share with us your thoughts overall on innovation. How do you succeed in that space? Maybe some practical recommendations to really, you know, build and foster such environment.
Yeah, sure. Pleasure to do so. And it's really innovation, and it's as you very well put it, it's every day, right? It's nonstop. You got to think outside the box every single day. So in my experience, and I'll tell you, you know, even from my background, in my experience, I think innovative cultures, I think they start with a philosophy and a tone. One similar to, again, going back to being a dad, I think one similar to the classic parenting advice that you give to children, I think they need both roots and wings. I think you can also bring that to the corporate world. You know, as an innovation leader, I believe you must ground those creative people in accountability for your organization's objectives, right? I think you need to set the parameters on how to be innovative, what you need, what the mission is. And then I think you need to give them broad discretion to conduct work in service of those parameters, right? I think obsessing too much, and this goes back to, you know, practical recommendations and insight, I think I learned from experience that obsessing too much about budget and deadlines, I think it will absolutely kill ideas way before they get off the ground. And, you know, don't get me wrong, everyone works with budget. I work with budget, but I think micromanaging and just obsessing too much with it, I think just kills the creation process of it. And also, I think my whole mindset comes from the culture I was kind of trained within at BTG Pactual for, you know, 14 years. There were absolutely no walls. There were no private offices. I mean, if you had an idea, you're free to reach out to whoever you deem appropriate to make that idea happen, right? So I think that thing, that concept always stuck with me. And you know, I was sitting like 10, 12 desks away from the CEO, the COO, the CLO of the company. And I could hear from them. I could learn even just through osmosis. I could just get a few thoughts and ideas and process that. And you know, I think you can reinforce the cultural benefits of innovation just by simply opening up organizational space to allow folks to simply bypass barriers, to bypass ranks that often sap creativity. And one last thing, John, I truly believe that, you know, relationships that extend beyond the boundaries of your company or your firm are invaluable. I think acquiring and distributing knowledge, especially on the innovation front, I think it's paramount. And I'm fortunate and very grateful that the contacts I've built, you know, throughout my career, and now with the help of my good friend and partner at StoneX, I think we, it's possible to stay in touch with a diverse array of large companies, startups, venture capitalists, national labs, universities. So I gain so much from them. And I think this open concept allows for, you know, freedom, not just freedom of speech, but, you know, just freedom to do whatever you want, of course, with boundaries to accomplish a specific mission.
Right. Absolutely. That's definitely, it resonates on so many levels with what you're talking about from the just overall concept of innovation. So thank you for sharing that. So we've seen the last couple of years how just the markets have impacted the way companies hire, the way companies interview, the way companies just, you know, in general, the entire life cycle of a candidate from sourcing, recruiting, all the way to starting the job has just been a whirlwind of changes. But at the end of the day, we'll agree that the war for talent out there is real. The war on retention is even greater. Share your thoughts overall on the state of kind of the talent, at least in your industry. What are some of the strategies that really help maybe your company succeed in that space to be able to attract the top talent? Or maybe even on the other side, what do you consult with, or what advice do you provide maybe to some of your clients from that standpoint?
That's a really good question. And yes, hiring has been a struggle, which is, if you look at the macro, from a macro standpoint, is a good thing, right? The market's super hot, and there are a bunch of talent out there, and you need to act fast, not fast enough so you don't make a mistake in hiring, but you need to really act. So I think there are a few things from strategic development at our company, and hiring definitely is number probably one or two. But you know, I when you ask the question and say what do you do, I think many things, right? And well, actually, interesting question, because my first reaction was to simply say many things, but that would be against being strategic, right? So what I was trying to say is that just because of the nature of the business we're trying to build, it's just, we're cross-selling all the time, right? What here at StoneX, we're trying to connect, to bridge gaps, and to develop new markets and new types of relationships. So one of our key strategic areas of focus is truly cross-selling, right? So we're trying to become, through our relationships with, you know, individuals, families, is truly become a window of opportunity for them. So in a nutshell, I think there are maybe five topics that we consider really seriously. I think it's, you know, where we should be, maybe geographic footprint, who to connect with, networking. We're not trying to be the traditional bankers that, you know, I just want your money, I'll manage your money. No, if you're willing to talk to a life science guy that's, you know, working through, you know, battling cancer and finding new medicine and new solutions out of San Diego, we'll be happy to put you in contact with them. So you want to talk about venture capitalism in China? We have a bunch of managers that do that. So we want to do more than just the industry has been doing in terms of, you know, the traditional private banking world. So geographic footprint, networking. How to be operationally excellent. I think the customer experience now, because everyone is so connected and everything happens so fast, I think the customer experience needs to be at the forefront of whatever you're doing. You need to think about that every single day, and you need to be, different. Reporting, I think that ties into what I was just saying. I think in just not reporting in a mechanical way, it's reporting, it's more about creating a rapport with your client and being constantly close and understanding their plans, because life happens. You had a plan 6 months ago, but now you wanted to buy a house, you want to buy a boat, you want to, you know, take a sabbatical for a year. Life happens. So you need to be really ready for that. And the only way of correctly doing that is being present. And finally, you nail it. I think hiring. I think hiring is. I think we'd rather just wait months to get the right person. Unfortunately, we can't afford that at the present moment. And it's funny, we're going through this right now. We're hiring one key person to our team. And, you know, we had to act fast, but we had to consider so many things. So maybe it's a long-winded answer for you, John, but it's, I think, you know, five key topics for us.
Right, absolutely. That's definitely an area that we could probably discuss for the rest of the episode.
Oh, for sure.
Such a pressing topic these days. But in terms of kind of, you've had your share of getting experience in different companies of various size. And in terms of just the whole concept of interviewing is very interesting to me because it's very challenging. It's, you know, a lot of that I keep repeating myself on every podcast is that it's flawed because most of the interviews are based on your personal past experience versus the kind of focus on the strength that we're, you know, that are missing on our team, for example. How do you structure your interviews? How you know, maybe from the interviews you've participated in that you've noticed were a lot more effective than the other? Just share your thoughts overall on interviews.
Another amazing question. Thank you so much for that. And it's such a great topic, one that I truly love to spend time on. And it's exactly what you said. It's so challenging because it's you don't have that much time to make the decision, but you have to just understand the soft things that it's going on during an interview and make a decision on it. So I'll try to, you know, do my best here and filter all my thoughts. And it's actually, again, funny you ask because I usually tell folks that I speak way more than the interviewed person, to be frank. And that's just because of the nature and the vibe I want to set for the meeting. Something I always like to highlight at the get-go for anyone, look, we're all just human beings, right? I'm a human being, you're a human being. We're just trying to see if there is some chemistry here, we can work together. If my plan, you know, fits into your plan, if you want to contribute, it's a team. It's a team building exercise. So it's really important. So there won't be any tricky questions. There will probably be tough questions, not tricky questions. And there's nothing that can be asked away back to us because I need to be an open book. And again, the guys, the guy or girl, it's a person, it's a human being. So it's a plan that we want to build together. So I usually find that this it's kind of icebreaker. It creates a little bit of rapport. The person relax a little bit. And then it also gives me just an idea on how the emotional intelligence plays out, person relaxing, you know, just in the fitting of the interview, how much she or he relax, which to me, the emotional intelligence is really key. I'm in the wealth management industry. If you can't build rapport or you know, have the soft skills of emotional intelligence, it's gonna be a really hard call. So I try to usually follow a fluid script. And actually I need to give kudos to a good friend, Wharton alumna, Alice Knopfels. She was so kind to share once her guidelines. She's been hiring for a long period of time. And she, you know, just share with me some practical guidelines. And when I read it, oh my God, this absolutely clicked and everything just made absolutely sense. So I think the intent of the interview is just to understand him or her better as a person and a potential coworker, what motivates them, what energizes them, and what they're already great at, or where they want to improve. And to your point, right, we focus too much on the background and what happened and not where we want to go. So you got to learn from what you did great and what you don't want to do it, so you can, you know, focus on what you do great and help the team. So to do that, I usually like to talk through their background at a deeper level of detail than maybe you would normally do in an interview. I love to walk through their journey, starting from, you know, college through today. And I like to classify it as a series of chapters, right? And John, a chapter can be whatever it means to them. It can be a job, it can be a role, a geography. You know, for me, a real serious chapter in my life was the geography, it was New York. So I spent 6 years there. It represented so much to me and that I can put so many pieces of the puzzle together because of that geography, right? But it's totally up to them. So and from then, I think, you know, for each chapter, I try to learn a key set of things, right? What was your intent? Why did you land there? right? What are you trying to accomplish? Number two, what was your proudest accomplishment? And I like to ask this question and try to find this thing, because, you know, as a lawyer in Brazil, lawyers don't usually, you know, 2 + 2 = 4, and we have really, lawyers are always really hard with finance. I probably went to the hardest finance exam in the world, the CFA exam, passed it, and this is probably the proudest accomplishment. And I like to see the passion coming out of the candidate, and this is one thing I like to see. And well, again, to your point, what was your biggest mistake or missed opportunity, right? I generally try to find out or peel the onion and these are, you know, the three main things, but I try to really find in everything that's happening in interview, I try to find 5 key things, right? And I call it the mission, it's the Tao, just like the Tao in the restaurant in New York, is thrive with accountability and ownership, right? So I think the first element is this person that low status or ego, is high grit? I mean, is number two, mission driven? Is this the person is going to be, you know, running the extra mile, is going to, you know, just surprise me positively every time? Three, and this is, I think, is very important as well, is this person able to lead? Because am I hiring someone who can replace me at some point and allow me to grow and do something else, you know, down 6 months, a year, 2 years, right? Four, I think emotionally intelligent and highly introspective. And this is funny. I learned from a good friend. This can happen or not, and depends on all the schedules and everything, but I usually like to have interviews during lunchtime at a restaurant. And because this way I can see how the person reacts to the waiter. If the person says, thank you, manners, how low they speak. So all those social soft skills that are so important in our industry, and I love, they're so present in a restaurant. I think they are just, I think it's fascinating. And finally, 5.5, I think because I came from you know, a legal background, I learned how to build things, and it was so tough, right? Before I learned to sell, I learned to build. So I think I'm trying to find if this person is operationally excellent. Is this person, you know, outcome oriented, perfection seeking? Is he or she organized, detail oriented? So, you know, I'm sorry again, long-winded answer, but I think those 5 key elements are, I think they're all paramount, and I truly, truly find, and an interview can take 30 minutes, 2 hours or 3 hours, but I really, really take the time to find out if I can understand. I leave the meeting knowing exactly from those 5 key elements if that person fits the bill or not.
I love the compartmentalization of responses always, whenever the response is segregated in specific buckets, which you've done exactly that. And thank you for that, because it allows for a lot easier digestion of such a complex area. When we talk about topics as such, it definitely resonates on kind of just the observations on the restaurant side, because I can't remember who that does, but there's someone really famous who basically actually schedules his interviews at the restaurant early for breakfast, and then he observes the same behavior. I gotta find that. But yeah, it definitely resonates on so many levels. And just overall, I think what you were talking about, how to structure that and just overall approach, I think it resonates from the overall talent acquisition, talent retention, interviewing, and just overall strategies for innovation. I think that's what segregates, you know, successful companies for, you know, versus that are trying to catch up. The kind of the second segment of each podcast, I love doing kind of the rapid fire, just a heat check type of segment, where I ask you a question and it's, you know, you provide a quick answer. Does that sound like, you know, okay?
Let's do it.
In terms of your content diets, the sources that you consume on a daily basis to keep yourself informed, educated, share with us those.
Yeah, that's a really good one. Because I'm always on the go, either traveling, you know, flying, driving, meetings, etc. I think podcasts, I find, you know, just like yours, it's easy way of learning. I think I learn easier listening than reading actually all the time. So podcasts, you know, Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, Bloomberg, and just because of my industry, I need to have those. But I love the New Yorker, the Atlantic as well. I try to read those magazines. And John, just books, lots of books. I know I try to compensate with podcasts just to, instead of just books, something to listen.
So now that you bring up books, share with us what book are you maybe currently reading, or is there a book that you always recommend to others, and why is that?
Oh man, that's a tough question. I don't think I'm able to just give you one book, but
share a couple.
I'll share a few. I think, you know, a couple books here for you. I think the first two are from Ryan Holiday, and I love the guy. I think the Obstacle is the Way, combined with Ego is the Enemy, both from Ryan Holiday. I think they're just absolutely great. And also Leaders Eat Less and Start With Why, both also from Simon Sinek. And I say those because I was very fortunate to read these books, not necessarily in this order, in a critical moment of my career, where I was struggling a little bit to find meaning and maybe peace, but still had a lot of energy to contribute. So I think all these books touch upon some chapters of my life in a special way.
Those are great recommendations, and we'll make those titles available in the show notes. You've been in wealth management investing for quite some time as a professional. I'm sure you've had your great share of great advice or recommendations that you had received through all these years. What are some of the most favorite that you really, you go back to even these days in terms of the words of wisdom?
Wow, that's a really, really good question. I probably need to think about it for a while. But one, I think it strikes me, and I think it probably reflects a little bit on my career. It's you first do whatever you have to do. You earn the title before you get the title. And that just gives you a little bit of the humble aspect of it. Just get work done. Focusing on solutions and people, and treating people the right way as well. So I think, you know, maybe it was, you know, poorly put, but it's just an idea of, you know, keep your head down, just do good work, focus on the outcome, not on essentially, you know, money is important, but it's not just about money. Life is more than that.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you for that. That's a powerful advice. And who is your mentor? Who do you consider someone that you definitely look up to, someone who inspires you, and why is that?
Well, John, I think it's probably going to be on a more personal note than you're expecting. But
of course,
I think my mom, she's been battling and winning, thank God, leukemia for 8 years now. And her inner strength and power is just something that absolutely blows me away every day. And she's been, you know, my source of inspiration for so many years. And also, let me, you know, on a less personal note, then I think Simon Sinek and Joe Duran, that Joe is now at Goldman Sachs, are just two guys that I'll probably work for like tomorrow. I think they're a combination of human touch, intellect, emotional intelligence, knowledge, mission. It's something that inspires me. I want to be like them in the near future, if possible.
Well, we definitely appreciate you opening up and wishing a speedy recovery, and can't even imagine what you're going through. So definitely that's very powerful. Thank you for sharing that. And just overall, Felipe, this was such a, you know, insightful conversation, at least for me, learned quite a bit. I know it was short, but it went by so fast. What I love doing with all the guests on the podcast is do a follow-up recording in about a year, where we actually revisit the conversation from a year ago, see how much, you know, have changed, transpired. And I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you as well.
That's a great idea. Let's do it. Absolutely. And again, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.